Hello and a most warm welcome to all of you. This is Victoria Duda again from Zenith Lifestyle, and I'm bringing you a new episode of the Metaphysical Podcast, episode 8, which is about near-death experiences. The last few times we have spoken about out-of-body experiences, those really mind-boggling things that, for all people who have personally experienced them, serve as a kind of personal proof that consciousness can indeed exist outside the brain, outside the body. And there is a very specific case of out-of-body experiences that occurs when a person is either dying, perhaps suffered an accident or a terminal illness or something like a cardiac arrest, or is actually in a clinical sense dead, but could be brought back into life by the means of modern medicine. So in those cases that the literature calls near-death experiences, some of them are experiences where the person was clinically dead. So there is no heartbeat, there is no blood pressure, and most importantly, the brain itself is dead. And in the last couple of decades, scientists and people who were pioneers in this field have learned a great deal about what actually is death. But perhaps the research is not so widely known as it should be, because death in our society is actually a taboo. If you look at it anthropologically, you know, we can see that in all societies, there are certain things that are actually taboo, and sometimes there's a certain food that you're not allowed to eat, or it's a certain god whose name you're not allowed to say out loud. And it's quite natural for a human society to have taboos. What is actually quite unnatural is that one of the most fundamental things about existence, namely the question of death, is a taboo. And of course, no one says that it is a taboo, but we behave accordingly. So just imagine yourself bringing up the issue of death at a dinner table and how people would normally react to that. Or if someone would die and you would just like graphically try to bring it into conversation, the details. It is not socially accepted to talk about death. And that is in our Western culture almost a kind of disease and almost a kind of psychological disorder that we have as a society. Because as a result of the fact that we don't talk about death, we either completely ignore it, and that is in psychological terms a kind of denial. If something is fundamental and important and we ignore it, then that's a denial. And we cannot be healthy if we live with a fundamental denial. So we either suppress it, deny it until the very end, when it potentially becomes a traumatic experience because the person is not prepared for it. So many of us are in denial of death or are actually in terror of death, afraid of it. And that is a taboo that I believe we have to break so that we can function not just healthily as a society and not just allow people to die a dignified and meaningful death, but also to live a meaningful life. Because how can we live a meaningful life if we don't know where it's leading us, if we don't have our own personal philosophy about what the end of life is and where that is leading? I was actually personally quite lucky because I came in touch with this issue rather early. I remember I was about 14 years old and I saw a book on my mother's table. And the book had a tunnel on its cover. At the end of the tunnel, there was an eerie light, and the whole thing looked a bit scary, but also very intriguing. So I picked up the book because I was a bookworm, and I read everything that was lying around. And I just randomly opened it somewhere. And it was actually Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life. The famous book that is first telling about people's experiences who had these near-death experiences. But I didn't know much about that, or in fact, that was my first encounter with Raymond Moody and his research. So I just randomly opened a book somewhere, and I remember I read a sentence something like, I know now what the Valley of Death is because I've been there. And I remember the sentence scared me so much. I shut the book, put it down on the table, and actually went out of the room. And a little bit later, I sneaked back in, and I was circling around that book like around some hot fire. And eventually, I mustered up the courage, but it was scary for a 14-year-old, and read the whole thing. And that fear of the unknown that stayed with me for quite a while, but ultimately it disappeared. And I was beginning to be more and more intrigued to learn about this phenomenon, especially after I had out-of-body experiences myself. So in the book, I was reading about those elements of these near-death experiences that seemed to be universally common. And it was Moody who first enlisted them in a way that they become a kind of pattern that doesn't mean that everybody who has a near-death experience has to go through all these elements, to all these steps of the process, but it does mean that they are likely to come up. Most importantly, what people who had a near-death experience say that it is something that they can talk about, but words are never going to do justice to the experience. So it seems that what they're trying to say is that in that state beyond the physical life, the laws of physics as we know it, especially the coordinates of space, the coordinates of time, the human coordinates of logic, and the very fact that life is a story that has a beginning and middle and an end, and it kind of follows a chronological sequence, that no longer applies. So they all say that they are doing injustice to that experience when they are trying to talk about it. Especially because, and the overwhelming number of people says that, because death, as they experienced, this was something wonderful. They are experiencing a genuine spiritual experience that is hard to put in words, but that is giving them the sense that there is an underlying unity, meaning, and intelligence in the universe. The experience itself starts with an out-of-body state. So people say things like, I've never been so alive, but I heard that the doctor in the room was saying that I died, and I suddenly felt myself floating up the ceiling. They also report this extreme feeling of real, that it is not a hallucination, it's not a dream, that it's something distinctly different from that. Similarly, as people who had out-of-body experience say that, no, if you experience it, you know that it's not a dream, it's not a hallucination, etc. It was quite interesting, actually, because I was reading a book on the subject on a bus this Monday, and a lady who was sitting next to me, she kind of put her nose into my book and asked me what I was reading, so I showed her the title page, and she said, oh, wow, you are interesting. why are you reading this kind of subject? So I said, well, I'm preparing a podcast about that, and I'm generally interested in these kind of things. And then she opened up and she said she had an experience like that as well. So I asked her to tell me about it, and she was in a hurry. She had to get off the bus. But the main message that she was bringing is that it was an out-of-body experience. And then she said, and that was full of passion, what she wanted to communicate. She said, but you have to know it was real. I didn't invent it. It was real. It was more real than my life is at the moment. So there is a sense when these people come back that this physical reality is actually more like a dream. And when they go back into the non-physical realm, so to speak, then that is more real than our life was. And usually the experience involves going through a tunnel or going in some other way into a non-earthy environment But frequently people meet dead relatives, or sometimes spiritual guides, or Jesus, or another religious figure, a little bit depending on the people's religious background. And very interestingly, in a lot of cases, they also go through a life review that is usually facilitated by somebody, for example, by the spiritual guide or by Jesus, that allows that person to go through their entire life once again. But interestingly, it's not happening chronologically. That's why we call it a panoramic life review, because it's something that allows you to see your entire life in one, but in incredible detail, where every deed, every action that you did that happened to you in your life is revealed also in its consequences. So what you've caused with your actions to other people. So you are a watcher of this, but also the receiver. You also get the feeling of those people that interacted with you. And you have a sense of knowing what kind of feelings you caused them with certain actions. And it's probably important to say that this panoramic life review doesn't seem to be like a judgment. It's more like a teaching, where a compassionate being is guiding you to understand what life is about and how much you have fulfilled the main goal in life, which is repeatedly, this is coming back over and over again, is to learn how to love. The meaning of life, if we look at it from a near-death experience point of view, when we get the message from people who came back from death, they say the meaning of human life is learning how to love. And after that, obviously, there is a kind of border that these people don't cross. Sometimes they are sent back in order to return to this earth, and sometimes they are told that it is because they have a mission still to fulfill. Interestingly, all the communication that seems to happen in this non-physical state, for example, when people are floating out of their body and hear the doctor or the nurse saying that, oh my God, this person is dead, or if they communicate with their guides or with their dead relatives, it doesn't seem to be an auditory experience. They don't hear anything, but they seem to know a communication from mind to mind or from heart to heart. And I find it interesting to compare this with the research of Helen Wambach, who regressed people through hypnosis into actually not the death, but the birth experience, which is quite interesting that through this technique, people can remember how they experienced their own birth. And that's also quite interesting because it shows similarities as well. Yeah. So these people who hypnotically regress into their birth experience, they report the same thing. They say in that moment when they are born, they are actually fully conscious beings. And they are aware of what's going on in the room, but not by understanding language, but by being in a sort of telepathic or whatever you want to call it, connection with everybody who's in the room. They feel the feelings of the mother. Interestingly, those feelings are quite often negative. It's the joy of a new baby is mixed in with a lot of fear or rejection or pain. And they are also aware of the feelings and thoughts of the helping people, you know, the doctors and the midwives. And there is a big difference in how they perceive their own birth. If, for example, the midwife is a compassionate, loving being, that is very well perceived. But if she's clinical and cold, then it's a shock for the baby. So it seems that when a soul is, so to speak, arriving into this world and when the soul is leaving this world, then the communication is happening on a mind-to-mind level. Something also extremely interesting is that in very few cases, these cases are rare, but they occur. Raymond Moody talked about these cases where people see even beyond their own panoramic life review in their near-death experiences. And they see a little bit more of what is awaiting us in that non-physical state that is our state after physical life. And they report that there seems to be an actual institution of higher learning, if you want to put it like that, where our souls, if you want to put it like in these terms, or our consciousness, our spirit, whatever you want to call it, goes to learn more. So beyond the panoramic life review, there is more learning. And that could be a learning about the previous lives, what the person did well, what kind of mistakes the person did, but also possibly in preparation of future lives. There is a very interesting film, a very interesting Brazilian film called Astral City, written after the book from Chico Xavier, who saw this story that the movie is presenting in a vision, in a metaphysical vision, where a person is dead, going through the similar kind of experiences that I've been speaking about, and then visits this astral city, which is a place to prepare the souls for the journey. It's worth watching it. Very, very interesting. One of the things that people report as frustrating from near-death experiences, that they come back because they often are told that they have a mission to fulfill. Interestingly, most of them are reluctant to come back because they enjoy that infinite peace and love that they are experiencing. But they have to come back. Sometimes it is because to take care of their children, if they have some children or a certain person. But very often they are just sad. You have to go back because you have a mission to fulfill. And frustratingly, never ever are they told what that mission is. And that is something that I find very striking, that we are all, to a certain extent, interested in why are we alive and what is our mission. And it's one of the trickiest questions in psychology to find an answer for. So I've never found, I researched, and of course I found some techniques that can help somebody to find their life mission. But it's one of the harder things to pin down. And maybe the reason why that is can be answered, by Viktor Frankl, who is the founder of logotherapy, the type of psychotherapy that is based on finding the meaning of life. And Viktor Frankl was the one who survived 3 years in a Nazi concentration camp and turned that experience into something positive by asking himself the question, who are the people most likely to survive an experience like that? And he came to the conclusion that it is those people who found a meaning in their lives, who found something to live for. But also Viktor Frankl found that it's not given what our meaning is. It's not something that we can go and search for and then we will find a secret papyrus or a secret script somewhere in a cave or in a pyramid, and then it will be written there what is our meaning in life and what is our mission to fulfill. Or we can't even go into an out-of-body state, or we can't go into a near-death state and just get a simple answer. Probably because, and that's Viktor Frankl's answer, because as human beings it is our work to give our life meaning. Of course we have a sense of mission that we are prepared for, and we all have a personal mission that we can more or less find. But it also includes the fact that we are giving our life meaning as we go. And we evolve consciously. And we co-create not just our life, but as it seems also our death consciously. Now, these stories that people are reporting are fascinating. And they are especially fascinating because they seem to be consistent with not just modern time research, but also research and tradition in different cultures that found the study of death important, like, for example, the ancient Egyptians or the Tibetans. Of course, modern science that is based on the materialist paradigm tried to explain these cases in material terms. And there have been a couple of theories, for example, saying that the soul has to do with the brain being deprived of oxygen or overloaded by carbon dioxide. Basically, in one way or the other, they say this is like a hallucination of the dying brain. Interestingly, none of these theories, and I don't want to go deeply into them right now, but none of these seem to be completely logical. However, instead of going one by one into these materialistic theories and trying to disprove them or prove them or whatever, I want to bring in something else into the discussion that actually cuts through all these materialistic theories with one argument. And this other thing that I want to bring into the discussion is what we call a shared near-death experience. These are less well known than the near-death experiences themselves, but they do occur quite often. And actually, when I first heard about them, I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, I actually had an experience like that myself. And I will talk about it in a minute. So shared near-death experiences are situations where imagine someone dying, like an old grandmother, and then a family member or a loved one is sitting at her bed and holding her hand. And as grandmother is dying, and grandmother is properly dying, so she's not coming back, she's really dying, she dies and she stays wherever, but that family member who's holding her hand or is with her in the room experiences the same sequence of events. The out-of-body state, both go out of their bodies, both float up to the ceiling, maybe even both go through the tunnel. Both might actually meet the spiritual guide. But of course, that person who's the family member, who's the loved one, will at this point be sent back, and grandmother is going to die. But because these experiences occur frequently, that cuts through the materialistic theory that these phenomena are just products of the dying brain, because these relatives, these loved ones, they don't have a dying brain. Their brain is not deprived of oxygen. Their brain is not overloaded with CO2 or whatever. It's not a shock reaction of a dying body, because they are completely healthy, young individuals. And I said, when I heard about these, it reminded me of something that I experienced when actually somebody died who wasn't a human being, but was Richie, my dog. And Richie was dying, and Richie was so old that actually the vet said, there's nothing wrong with your dog is only dying. I actually loved this sentence, because it just showed that death is nothing unnatural. You know, the vet who said that, she's a very, very authentic lady. Yeah, she seemed to be a very authentic lady to me. And she said, that's just it, you know, and you're lucky because he's dying of old age and there's nothing, he's not in pain or, you know, you don't have to do anything, just take him home. But he stopped drinking, he stopped eating and he stopped drinking. So I knew that he will die soon, and I had him in my bed. And I actually, this is probably interesting to mention as well, because I had that thought that I have to let him go, that I was holding him back artificially because I just didn't want to let him go. And I thought, okay, it's time to let go. And I actually thought this. I said, okay, I'll let you go now. And he died within a minute. And his death wasn't pretty biologically, because it must have been a heart attack that, you know, let go of all the body fluids that were. But spiritually, what happened after that was just indescribable. That is probably the best word. I didn't see anything visually because I'm not a visual person anyway, but I could feel. And this is something that is congruent with other people who are talking about shared experiences, that the geometry of the room, and this sounds a bit weird, but this is the only way you can explain it, that the geometry of the room just changed. It's almost like there was a vortex that was moving upwards, a spiral that is becoming bigger and bigger as you go higher and higher. And it was a minute where the two worlds were meeting and open. And you could literally feel that something was floating up. Some people actually see it. I've heard reports where people see that they say the soul of the deceased was leaving. They see maybe a little roundish something around their heart and that's floating up. Or some other people, they see a transparent replica of the body, literally like you would be drawing an out-of-body experience and just floating upwards. So I could feel something floating upwards. And it was extremely peaceful and extremely beautiful. And despite the fact that I was really grieving after this, I felt very much at peace, because I just knew that my friend Richie the dog went to a good place. I was never since doubting the existence of an existence after our earthly existence. And also the experience showed that animals work very similar. And what happens to us happens to them as well. Moody reported a case that I found very interesting, where there was a shared death experience between a pair of identical twins, but they were apart from each other. They were separated through three states, and one of the brothers died. And why this brother died, three states far away, the other brother, the twin brother, had a shared near-death experience. Which is not surprising, knowing that twins have a connection that goes beyond what most people have. Very interestingly, what these near-death cases show us, and every researcher who actually took these cases seriously and read through the material and done his or her own research, they come to the conclusion that something points into that direction, that really consciousness is not a product, and it's not a product of the brain, and it's not a simple byproduct of chemical processes in the brain or whatever. And it also seems to indicate that consciousness and memory are not necessarily stored in the brain. And this new paradigm is actually taking root also among scientists. For example, Penrose, the physicist, said that consciousness cannot be a product of the brain. Cannot be understood as simply a product of the brain anymore. And this is a good place to remind ourselves yet again, we've spoken about this previously, that thinking that consciousness is a product of the brain is actually an assumption, that there is no scientific data supporting that. It is quite obvious, and we don't have to go into science, we just can, you know, rely on our everyday experience, that our brain has to do something with our consciousness and our memories and our cognitive processes. Yes, if we have a brain damage, then we can't process the information. We might, you know, have a brain damage and then forget. We might even forget to speak, or we might just forget one particular language that we used to speak and then no longer. And there have been a lot of, not so very nice surgery into the brain that proves that if you cut a piece out, then there will be damage to the quality of consciousness itself. So obviously there is a correlation, and that is beyond the shadow of a doubt, I would say. But the fact that there is a correlation does not at all prove that there is a causality. It would be the same thing as to assume that because I need my TV to watch the program, that the TV is producing the program. We all know that the TV is not producing the program. The program is produced somewhere in the distance, and it is broadcasted to, and the television set is mainly picking it up. And we need the television set to watch it. But that's about it. That's the only correlation there is. But the television set is not producing the program that we are watching. In the same way, the brain is involved in the whole consciousness, consciousness on earth, consciousness in this physical reality, but it doesn't mean that it is its origin. So I think global communication is a good example for the fact that also the internet, you know, I can, for example, use my computer to create a website, and then I put that website on the internet. And after that, I can destroy the original computer that I used to make that website, but it doesn't harm the website itself. That can be stored through many other means. So I believe these are things that we have to take very seriously. We have to ask ourselves, what is life? And one of the lessons from near-death experiences is that when we die, then our life gets a new quality. That before we die, life is essentially a story. Elie Wiesel said that God made man because he loves good stories. And it seems that if you assume that consciousness is a kind of fundamental in the universe, then the universe is no longer a kind of mechanistic clockwork, but it is more a thought, big cognitive process. Sometimes I like to think of the world as based on consciousness, and then consciousness starts to create reality like a giant computer program going through all the possibilities that there could be, probably in order to search for the happiest version. So consciousness is focusing on particular stories, particular lives, particular situations in order to learn from it, in order to extract information about how to love, how to become the happiest, the most fulfilled. And each human life is an experiment into that. And when we die, it might be that we are just taking that information that we have gained throughout our life, and we present that information into consciousness as a whole. We bring it back into the Akashic Chronicle. We bring it back into the field. We bring it back into God, whatever we want to call the whole thing. And if this is the case, then there is nothing more important, in my opinion, than to find out the most what we can learn from these near-death experiences, and then learn through it how to live. Sogya Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher, said that there were two types of laziness. I really like that phrase. There are two types of laziness. There's a Western type of laziness and an Eastern type of laziness. And he says the Eastern type of laziness is what you can find in India, that people just sit the whole day in front of their little houses and do a little bit of work, but not too much, and they just chat and sit in the sun. And basically they avoid all sorts of activities. And Sogya Rinpoche says, but the Western type of laziness is the one where we just make ourselves so incredibly busy. We fill our diaries with appointment after appointment, that we don't have time and opportunity to think about the questions that really matter. And how many people in the Western world are like that? They don't think about life and death and why we are here. I'm finding that quite interesting that in my own hypnotherapy practice, when someone new comes and I start working with them, one of the questions that I like to ask, it's actually, in my opinion, the most important question for me, is what do you believe in? And I always explain that I don't quite mean, are you a Buddhist or are you a Christian? But I mean, what do you really believe in? So if an alien comes from another planet and you have to explain how the world works in this universe, the alien maybe doesn't even come from another planet, but from a completely different realm of reality, and you have to explain how does this universe work, how why we are here, who are we, where are we going, what would your guess be? What do you think is likely the answer to this question? And then I also ask people, what do they think happens when they die? And I'm actually asking this question because I'm finding that the results of therapy have incredibly to do with this question. It's very much linked to the people's personal beliefs. So I need to know that as a therapist. And then I ask, yeah, and what do you think what happens when you die? And I'm always surprised how many people actually answer, I never thought about it. They don't say I don't know or I haven't come to a conclusion, but they say, oh, I have actually never thought about that. I'm thinking, how can you not? It's the only thing that matters. Because if you assume that death is a joke, in other words, your life is a joke, in other words, when you die, it's going to be over and you'll be basically annihilated, then you cannot possibly live a meaningful life, can you? You can maybe say the meaning of your life is to raise your children and teach them, but then what is the meaning of their lives? It's a devil's circle because we just put the question to the next generation. But if we really want to live a meaningful life, then I totally believe that it begins with asking the question, what is a meaningful death? What is death? And what can we know about it? So for that purpose, I will, for the next broadcast, invite Penny Sartori, who's a prominent researcher of the near-death phenomena here in the UK, and she's the author of the book The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences. And I will ask and discuss with her the questions, how does actually a near-death experience change the people's lives that went through it? Similarly to how we've discussed the out-of-body experiences. Okay, it's an interesting phenomena, but what does it actually do to the people who personally experienced it? Does it radically change their lives? Because if these near-death experiences are real, if there is really a spiritual depth behind them, then they must do something with those people who experience that. And if it changes something in these people's lives, then, of course, we would be interested, what can we learn from them? What can we find out about the purpose of our own lives? And with these topics, I will be back in the next full moon. For now, I thank you so much for listening, and I thank you so much for being interested and being on the path of evolution by just taking your own thoughts and taking time to ponder, listen, and study about these questions that are so fundamental to our existence. Thank you very much, and I wish you a lovely month. Until next time.